ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National.
Very suave, erudite kind of guy.
We're here to surprise, delight, and maybe enrage you from time to time. We go where our curiosity leads.
Let's talk crazy. Let's act crazy. Let's be crazy, because then the enemy doesn't know what you're thinking.
Late Night Live, 4 new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Claire Nichols here, and on the book show today, let's start at sunset on a beach in Japan with Susan Choi and Flashlight.
Louisa and her father are making their way down the breakwater, each careful step on the heaved granite blocks, one step farther from shore. Her mother is not even on the shore, for example, seated smiling on the sand. Her mother is shut inside the small, almost waterfront house they're renting, most likely in bed. All summer, Louisa has played in the waves by herself because her mother isn't well, and her father is unvaryingly dressed in a jacket and slacks. But tonight, he has finally agreed to walk the breakwater with her. She's asked every day since they first arrived. Spray from the waves sometimes lands on the rocks, and so he has carefully rolled up the cuffs of his slacks. He still wears his hard, polished shoes. In one hand, he holds a flashlight, which is not necessary. In the other hand, he holds Louisa's hand, which is also not necessary. She tolerates this out of kindness.
That is the first page of Flashlight, the Booker shortlisted novel by the American writer Susan Choi. The book follows Louisa and her parents, her Korean dad, Sirk, her American mother, Anne, before and after this night on the beach when everything changes. I met Susan Choi on Wurundjeri Land in WA at the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival. Where are Louisa and Sirk? They're going for this walk. Where are they?
Yeah, they're in a small town on the coast of Japan. It's the late 1970s. They're on, this matters a little bit. They're on the, what you would call either the northern or the westward coast of Japan. And Louisa's father has just finished up doing some visiting teaching at a university in Japan, and her mother has not been feeling well, so they've taken a little house on the beach just for what's supposed to be the brief remainder of their time in Japan, to have a little relaxing, pleasant rest.
And they wouldn't normally get this close to the water, right? Well, Sirk wouldn't.
Well, he's an extremely, extremely overprotective father who's always expecting something horrible to happen. He's probably the kind of father who doesn't let Louisa have a hot dog at a friend's birthday party because of the preservatives. That's not in the book, but I'm actually thinking that would be like him. So he's very, very cautious. He's very overprotective of her. He is, you know, white-knuckling it when she herself swims in the water. So he's always being very, very watchful.
And then after this moment, Louisa is unconscious and Sirk is gone.
What happened?
That's the question of the story. Where did this scene come from?
I knew that I wanted to write a book about a family to whom an awful thing happens. And so this scene came to me really early, actually, in the writing of the book, even before I totally reconciled myself to the plot that I was dancing around it myself, thinking like, oh, can you really do this? I felt unsure I could get away with it.
And clearly she did. Sirk is a Japanese-born Korean. So at the end of World War II, in 1945, my research says there are about 2 million ethnic Koreans living in Japan. Can you explain why there were so many Koreans in Japan and what they were doing there?
Yeah, so Japan, the Empire of Japan, had been very aggressively expanding its reach. And Japan had a war with Russia. They expanded into China. Like, those of you who are knowledgeable about the Second World War, especially in the Pacific, will probably have like a certain amount of familiarity with a lot of this history. And one of the things that happened is that Japan seized Korea as a colony in 1910. Japan had already been really kind of like interfering a lot with Korea, and it's a long, complex history, but in 1910, it kind of became official that Korea became a colony of Japan, lost its sovereignty. And so that was the case until the end of the Second World War, when Japan is defeated and has to give up all its colonies. And this is the point at which modern Korea, that story begins. But meanwhile, while Japan is holding Korea as a colony, many, many Koreans ended up in Japan, either against their will — there were a lot of awful ways in which they were brought to Japan by force — or in some cases, large circumstances forced them, like mostly poverty. So a lot of Koreans migrated to the archipelago in search of a better life, because they were, as Koreans, they were now sort of subjects, not citizens — it wasn't great — but they were subjects of Japan. So this character's parents do the same thing. They're very poor, and they migrated to Japan in hopes of being able to feed the kids, basically.
This is such a fascinating history. It's not one that I knew a lot about. You have Korean heritage. Was this a history that you knew about?
No, I knew nothing about it. So I do have Korean heritage. My father's Korean. He was born in Seoul, Korea, in the late 20s under the Japanese Empire. So I was always, from adulthood, I became very fascinated by the history. And this little corner of the history, I knew nothing about. My father's own story is totally different. Mm-hmm. He was, like I said, born in Korea, not Japan. He was born to a very well-to-do, well-off, highly educated family, unlike this character, who it's the opposite. But this character's circumstances do come out of research that I was doing because of this larger interest in Korea because of my dad.
Mm-hmm. How much did you know about your Korean heritage? How much was that a part of your life growing up in Indiana, in America?
It was very little a part of my life. And almost to the point that, you know, when something becomes kind of a conspicuous absence, mm-hmm. or, you know, quiet spot, I think that I picked up pretty early on in my childhood that there was a silence around Korea. My father used to have nightmares when I was a little girl. I would hear him screaming and my mother waking him up. And I remember my mother sort of saying, like, oh, you know, he has nightmares about the war. It's okay. So I had this sense that he had lived through a war, that it was unspeakable. But it wasn't until I was probably just getting out of college and honestly like legal to drink, that my father and I had a little bit of a — I don't know if others have experienced this, I think what is called expansion of relationship to parent once you can have beer together. It's the technical term for it. But, you know, my father had always been very quiet about Korea. He never spoke Korean when I was little. And to be honest, was like a little bit of a dismissive person about it. Like, you know, he was very much about, you're an American, you don't need to know that, forget about it. But I think he really wanted to leave it behind. And it wasn't until, again, I was old enough to notice this and sort of sit down with him with a couple of bottles of beer. And then I'd say, you know, Dad, you've never really told me anything about the Korean War, or your experience. And that was when our conversations really began.
I've talked to so many novelists about this idea of, you know, being the first generation child of migrants and the parents keeping these stories from the children almost as a form of protection, right? Yeah. It's a form of love to say, I'm not going to burden my child with these stories of what I've experienced. But sometimes the opposite thing happens, where the kid feels distant from that parent, yeah, because they're not telling that story.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I understand it. And at the same time, I'm kind of furious with my father for not speaking. My father was beautifully fluent in Korean, Japanese, and English. Just think, how cool would it have been if I was fluent in Korean and Japanese as well as English? But I can't say the first thing in either of those languages because he never spoke them to me when I was a child. And the sensibility or the mindset was, don't interfere with the English language competency, American identity, you know, like leave all that baggage in the past. I don't think he could have anticipated how amazing I would have found it to be able to speak those languages in adulthood. So I resent it, frankly, but I understand.
When did you know you wanted to be a writer?
I think that I always wrote, and it was a matter of realizing that you could actually do it for a living, sort of. I mean, you honestly, I don't know if you really can, but I was, from a really early age, writing little stories. It was kind of just a pastime or like a way of playing that from really early on, like I would sit at my mom's typewriter and get it all messed up and get her keys stuck together. But I would make little, you know, stories, or I'd like create little books. And it was so big a part of my life. I would sometimes actually send my little stories off to the little children's magazine. I had a very exciting story about a spider that was awarded first place. Readers 5 to 8 years old, I think, if I'm being precise. So I loved writing, but by the time I was a teenager and a college student, I think I almost had like a sort of a dismissive attitude toward it. Like, oh, that's just a hobby. Or, oh, that's, I don't know. I don't think I consciously dismissed it, but I did have this dismissive attitude. And it wasn't until I graduated from college with like no skills at all that I started writing again kind of seriously and thought like, oh, is this a thing people could actually do full time? And I went back to it.
What had you studied at college?
Oh God. I mean, I barely graduated because I kept changing my course of study. I majored in everything. And and in the end, yeah, really, no, it's really true. And I try to tell this story a lot to my own students because I think there is this sense of like, you should have it all figured out. And I'm like, I'm a really good example of someone who did not have it all figured out and still maybe does not have quite a lot figured out. But in college, I think I was an American studies major, an art major, but I couldn't draw, so that didn't last. I considered being a theater studies major. I might have considered being a French major, but I was really bad at French. I ruled out being an English major because there was too much reading. And I ended up something called a literature major, which is such a questionable program of study because it was only literary theory and not actual literature, that I think that they have phased it out as kind of an embarrassment to the university. But that's what I did.
Okay. Susan Choi, you took a trip to Japan when you were a kid. Why did you go, first of all?
So our reasons for going were not that dissimilar to reasons that I ended up giving to the characters in the book, but much less cloak and daggery. My father was a mathematics professor, and his university had a sister school relationship to university in Japan. My father had a complicated relationship to Japan, you know, as mentioned, because he was born in Korea during the period of the Japanese Empire, was like a colonized subject of this empire. I think he had it inculcated in him to be very resentful of the Japanese, but he also had this, I think, even deeper love for Japanese culture and Japanese language because Japanese language was the first language he was educated in at school. It was the first literature he ever read. So I think he was really torn. He really wanted to go to Japan. And so off we went for just a visiting professorship of my dad's.
And how long were you there for?
We were there for like one semester in the summer, you know, like a little less than probably like six, seven months. But it was like in a period of time that now as an adult wouldn't seem like a huge period. But I was nine and I'd never been out of the United States, but I'd actually never even been out of the Midwestern United States. I'd never been further than Chicago, which was 90 miles away from the college town I grew up in. And so Japan was... And it was, my mind was blown as a kid. And also it was the 70s, so my parents did not really do a lot of hand-holding. They just kind of stuck me in a Japanese school with, you know, Japanese kids who did not speak English, Japanese teachers who did not speak English. I think my sensei spoke a little English, which is why I was placed in his class. But it was a really sink or swim kind of culture shock. And I never forgot it. So I always wanted to use it in my writing somehow.
And did you sink or did you swim?
I swam. It's so kind of weird to think about it now because I don't really understand where my parents were. But I have like all of these memories of friendships and just running around. It was a sort of a, you know, I don't know, it was a town maybe the size of this one.
Mm-hmm. We're in Margaret River, yeah.
Yeah, Margaret River, big enough to have all the stuff, but small enough to, you know, feel kind of cozy, like you can run to the outskirts of town and be in fields. And I just remember like running loose with other kids and spending money on candy, and I guess I did schoolwork. I don't even know. But I just remember having a real life in that town. I think I might have been doing the grocery shopping like Louisa does, because I have memories of going to the shopping store and buying things. And
on your own?
Yeah. And I don't... one of the abiding mysteries of my life is, was I speaking Japanese? No one seems to know. I certainly don't retain any recollection of it at all. But it seems like I got along, you know, that it just sort of became possible for me to like, I had friends. I think that's what really I remember is having playmates.
That's so lovely. It's really fascinating to hear you talk about your dad and your dad's history, to talk about your trip in Japan and hear how all these ideas have kind of filtered into something like this. I guess the key question, Susan, is how much of you and your family are in this novel Flashlight?
I mean, I think that it is, if you can imagine kind of a process where you start out with certain very familiar conditions, like my family, this trip, and then you start adding unfamiliar things that really ratchet up the pressure. So I started, of course, with this novel, adding all sorts of circumstances that didn't actually occur in our lives. As you do that and you start thinking like, oh, how are we going to respond to these extreme circumstances? Slowly we turn into these characters. So the characters start developing and changing and becoming themselves and becoming different from who we were as the situation gets more and more elaborate and complex. So I would say that, you know, it started out as a book that had these familiar ingredients in it and then ended as a completely different story about pretty different people.
Mm. On ABC Radio National, this is The Book Show, coming to you from the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival. I'm Claire Nichols and I'm speaking to Susan Choi about her wonderful Booker shortlisted novel, Flashlight. So Louisa's parents are Cirque and Anne. These are two people who I say Susan Choi should not be married to each other.
It was a terrible, terrible idea. What were they thinking?
Cirque is this ethnically Korean, born in Japan, finds his way to America, and he's going to meet this white woman, Anne. What draws these two to each other in the first instance?
Yeah, I think to be crass, I think it's pure physical attraction. I think there was chemistry. You know, sometimes chemistry can exist in extremely high amounts between people who are extremely poorly suited. I'm not saying it's a necessity. I hope not. But they certainly seem to have like an almost chemical reaction. But I think even beyond that, Cirque has had a very, very difficult life. He's very angry already. He is this very, very smart, very, very fierce, very, very determined guy. Grew up in poverty, has managed by hook or by crook to get himself to the United States. And I think he really wants to slam the door on the past. And in this respect, I really was thinking about my dad. Mm-hmm. My dad was quite similar. And Anne, for her own reasons, has really slammed the door on her past. You know, so Anne, for those of you who haven't read the book, I don't think this is much of a spoiler. Anne has made a really, really bad decision in her sex life, and there have been lasting consequences, and she has kept those consequences a secret for most everyone, including most of her own family. So Cirque and Anne are totally different, but they're actually oddly similar. They both don't want to talk about the past at all. And when they meet, I think each senses that the other isn't maybe going to ask too many hard questions because they don't want to be asked those questions. So they kind of take shelter in each other, but unfortunately, their temperaments are not gentle. Neither of them is a very gentle person.
Is this an analysis of your parents' marriage as well?
Oof. Well, dot, dot, dot. And I'm thinking, Mom, how much internet radio listening do you do? It is a bit. It is a bit. I have to say, I think that if my mother were here, what would she say? They were awfully good-looking people, my mom and dad, and they were very, very different. I think they would agree right away that they were very, very different. And my mother would say that once it came to living together and actually, you know, building a day-to-day domestic life and having a budget and a kid, the whole thing really, really went south very quickly. It's interesting because my parents had a very volatile relationship themselves, but once they split up, they really remained friends for the rest of their lives. I mean, my father has passed away, my mom is still around. But to very late in their lives, they would still get on the phone to talk about the wonderful subject, me. You know, so I united them.
Well, that's pretty special. You've mentioned how strict Cirque is, how angry Cirque is. And, you know, he is so paranoid about the safety of his child. Like, where does that come from? What is it about him?
That is autobiographical, to be totally honest. Like, ripped the Band-Aid off. But I don't know why. So one of my father and Cirque have quite different biographies. Their resumes are very, very different. But temperamentally, there are a lot of borrowings that I made from my poor father, who has been borrowed from for so many of my books. And while he was still alive, he was such a good sport about it, too. He really was. And other books even more so. If you're interested in this father figure, I refer you to my oeuvre, especially books 1 and 3. But with this book, I think that tendency to be hyper-protective to the point of almost insanity is something that I remember really clearly. And my mother would have her stories to tell. I mean, you know, my father would just freak out if... I think I wasn't allowed to play with glitter, maybe until like the age of 6 or 7, because my father was convinced I would eat it as if I was some kind of idiot. And then, you know, that it would prove toxic, which I think glitter is not really that. It's not, obviously you shouldn't make it part of your regular diet, but but it's, I think it's not going to kill you. Yeah. But he was like that. He was really fearful. And I don't know where it came from. And my mother, I think, was quite mystified by it too. And it was touching, you know, and even to adulthood, you know, he would call me and he would want to know about my life. And if I mentioned anything involving a car trip, he would always say, "Oh, honey, drive carefully." He was always so worried.
Mm. Must be a hard way to live, being worried all the time.
Yeah, I think it was very hard.
I'm thinking about Louisa being the child of these two very poorly matched parents. Like, what does that mean for a kid? What kind of kid comes from that kind of very volatile couple?
Yeah. Well, I think with Louisa, because the circumstances of the book, again, are much more, you know, complicated and glamorous than the circumstances of my life. Speaking of her, I thought that as a kid she would have an instinct that her parents were both secretive, but of course she's not going to know what the secrets are. But I felt like kids can feel that. I really think they can sense that. With my own kids, I always knew, like, you can't hide anything. They might not know exactly what you're hiding, but they know you're hiding something. Mm-hmm. So I felt that Louisa would know both of her parents are hiding something from her, from each other, and it makes her quite obstreperous. But I think it must have been, again, for Louisa, this fictional character, but I think it must be lonely, quite lonely.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Anne, the mother, is not well in this book. Her symptoms start before the family leaves for this trip to Japan, but things really, really escalate for her while she's there. And there seems to be a belief within the whole family unit for some period of time that maybe it's not real, maybe this is just Anne being dramatic. And yeah. I think perhaps most worryingly, for a while there, I think Anne might believe that too, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So this is very, very much, I mean, there, like I've spoken about this kind of, you know, hybrid quality of some aspects of the story where they you know, might begin in autobiographical mm-hmm. circumstances, but then they evolve quite far away. But this really is something that actually more, as I was writing the book, evolved closer and closer to reality, if that makes sense, because my mother has MS, multiple sclerosis, and she was diagnosed in my childhood. I didn't plan on writing about it in this book when I was first sort of cooking up this book in my mind. First of all, I didn't even really know how far I would follow these characters. That was one of the big questions. I meant the book to be shorter and to cover less time. So when I realized that we were going to follow the characters for more years, Anne just started taking on symptoms, you know, almost as if, you know, there was sort of this biological process at work. I was like, oh dear, she's getting sick. And I realized at some point, I think I'd always wanted to write about my mother's illness. I wasn't aware of wanting to do it, but it was such a huge part of, still is, a huge part of our lives, obviously a huge part of her life, but also mine, because I was a child when she was diagnosed. And it was another one of these things that my father was very protective of me about. So when I was younger, my father really did not want my mother to talk to me about her illness at all, because he, I think magical thinking, was hoping that I wouldn't notice. Of course I noticed. Who wouldn't notice? But, you know, it was obviously a coping mechanism of his. So later in life, when I did have an opportunity to talk to her a lot about it, one of the things that she told me was that, you know, MS is a devilishly horrible disease, if anyone suffers from it or knows someone who suffers from it. And it can take many, many forms. It's very, very hard to pin it down, especially during the period that she was first ill, which would have been early to mid-1970s. Not that much was known. And she told me that she really did think that she was crazy for a while, that she really did think it was all in her head, that it was some sort of psychosomatic phenomenon, because you couldn't really see it. But she felt it, you know, like my legs keep going out from under me. You know, when I reach for a coat in the coat closet, I miss. Like these things kept happening, that it was invisible in a way. Only she was experiencing it. And so she did have that fear. And she did also tell me, and I put this in the book, that when she was finally diagnosed, she was so relieved. Because finally, like, it had a name and it was a real thing.
Yeah. Louisa, as a child, it seems quite resentful towards her mother for being not well. And I admired this so much about the book, because I think there is some sort of ugly truth there, right? In this idea that we would never say out loud that I just don't want you to be sick. It sucks that you're sick and it's annoying that you're sick, but maybe that's how we feel.
Yeah, and she's a little girl. Yeah. And no one tells her the truth. I can only cite my mother, who's very nice. I did check with her on this, and my mother assured me that I was not obnoxious in the manner that the character is. But it's possible that I had those feelings and didn't show them or express them. And I had a wonderful experience talking to a reader who's a social worker, and I met her at an event like this, and she came up to me afterwards, and she said, Louisa needed to be cared for. She wasn't being cared for, and it made her angry. And she said that was a very logical reaction, which made me feel really good. Poor Louisa, because she is kind of hard to take. She misbehaves horribly. She really acts out, I guess, would be what we would call it.
Mm. How do you feel when people say, I don't care for Louisa, she's a brat?
I feel two ways. I often laugh. I mean, when I published the short story Flashlight that came out in 2020, and that was, you know, sort of a kernel of this book, but hadn't published the book. I did a reading at a university for a bunch of college students, and afterwards in Q&A, it emerged that I was working on expanding into a book, and one of the students raised her hand and said, "Does that mean we'll like be with Louisa for a long time?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so." And this student goes, "What a nightmare." And I just cracked up because it is funny. But I also feel a little sad and protective of her. And I mean, readers, your mileage may vary, but I do really think that in the course of the book, Louisa does achieve some grace. Mm. You know, she does become a little less prickly.
I care so much for all the characters in this book, and I love their prickliness and their hardness. I did want to talk about with Anne, the mother character. You know, she is hard, and I think she's hard almost by necessity as a coping mechanism. Those of you who have read it will know, you know, she meets the wonderful Walt, and there's this fabulous romance she has with the neighbour, Walt. And he is pure goodness and pure kindness. And she is so cruel to him. And she knows she's being cruel. She knows she could just say thank you to him.
I know.
But she can't bring herself to do it.
She just can't let him in. She's so mean. Not throughout, but she makes it very, very difficult for him to get close.
You started this as a short story. You said you didn't know how big this story was going to go. Like, when did it become clear to you that, oh, this is a 400-page novel?
I mean, probably around page 400, actually. And I was really disappointed.
Yeah?
I didn't know... Well, I mean, even worse than not knowing it would be a 400-page novel, but it reads very fast.
It does.
Don't be intimidated. Also, they printed it to look extra large. It's not... no, I'm kidding, but it is over 400 pages. That's unfortunately not... We can't finesse that. Not only did I not know it would be 400 pages plus, but my inspiration text, as I think of it, or sort of this the book that had kind of fired my imagination and first made me think, ooh, I want to write about that time in Japan, is what I first thought. I want to write about that childhood experience I had in Japan and try to write about these other swirling issues that are interesting to me. The book was a novella of 150 pages called Visitation by Jenny Erpenbeck that's about 20th century German history, and the most beautiful book. And I read that book and I was just electrified. And I thought, oh, this is what I'm going to do, is I'm going to write this beautiful 150-page novella about other things. And so I literally envisioned this book as a novella. And it's the longest book I've ever published. So the opposite of a novella in just about every way. And I think... It's hard to say exactly when I really did know that it was going to be that long, but, you know, at some point I started working with my wonderful, wonderful U.S. editor who really made this book what it is. And it was very long then. I think it was longer, but also very different. It was longer with different stuff. And she read it and we sat down together. And I don't know how this happened, but in talking together, and I got very excited because we'd never worked together before, but I understood right away, like in the way that when you meet someone that understands you, you know, and she understood the book, and I thought, oh, she understands the book better than I do. So we were talking excitedly, and at some point we both began using this metaphor of brushing a dog that's too fluffy. And we kept saying, like, well, we just have to brush it out and get all the fluff away, like the way you would groom a dog, and then it'll be perfect. So that was the first thing we did, was we brushed the dog. But it turned out that she then also wanted me to add things. Then the dog became, once it had a glossy coat, it then got fed up and became even bigger.
I mean, it's such a fantastic novel, and that was recognised with you making the Booker shortlist in 2025. I know from talking to other shortlisted writers over the years that week is really intense, the week of the announcement. What's your strongest memory of that time in the UK and the Booker announcement?
I think it's possible that my strongest memory is... So my son, my younger son, who's 18 years old, is in school in Germany right now, and finishing up. Actually, he's finishing up in a mere matter of days. But this, in last November, he was in Germany, and I had called him to tell him about this exciting event, and I said, do you want to come to London for the Booker Prizes? And he was like, sure, if you're paying for the ticket. And so I said, well, what's your class schedule? And he said, well, you know, I'm in intensive German Monday through Friday. And I, you know, do you want to cut a class? And he said, yeah, I'll cut Friday German. The Booker Prize ceremony was Monday night. So I bought him a ticket to fly over to London on Friday, and he would leave early Monday morning to go take German class. And I don't know what we were thinking. And the Booker Prize ceremony being Monday night as it was, he showed up in London with like a backpack in like sneakers and a tattered hoodie. And then we all went out to brunch with Katie Kitamura, who's mm-hmm. an amazing writer and another shortlister. Yep. Author of Audition, her husband, Hari Kunzru, also an amazing writer, and Kiran Desai, who's also on the shortlist, mm-hmm. and Elliot, my son. And they said, oh, Elliot, isn't this amazing? Like, what are you going to wear to the ceremony Monday night? How excited are you about this? And he said, oh, I'm flying back to Germany Monday morning. I'm not going to the ceremony. And this silence fell around the table. And then everyone looked at me. And then he looks at me and he goes, well, she didn't want me to miss school. And it was so embarrassing because, of course, in that moment, we all realized, I was like, oh, crap. I shouldn't say that on the radio. But, you know, immediately Kieran and Katie were saying, like, just call your publicists. I'm sure they can get him a ticket. And he had nothing to wear. And so this huge effort was mounted to, like, find him a decent pair of shoes and a jacket. And anyway, he did come to the ceremony with me and he did look amazing, so handsome. He wore a suit jacket and shiny shoes. And so I think that whole arc of, for some reason, having the plan to bring my own child over to not go to the ceremony with me, that was very memorable. I mentioned that I don't have long-term planning capabilities.
Earlier today, I spoke to David Saloy, and he was talking about, before the ceremony, one of the judges, Kylie Reed, came up to him and she said, we really loved your book, in a kind of tone that made him think, oh, I haven't won it. I can move on. Tell me about your interaction with Kylie Reed before the ceremony.
So I had an interaction with Kylie, who's lovely, that caused Katie, who observed it from across the room, to quietly conclude to herself, oh, I guess Susan won, which was that I walked into the red carpet reception and Kylie Reed, who we'd never met in person, came beelining up to me with her face lit up like the sun. And she said, Susan, my chiropractor is your cousin. Which was really surprising.
But everyone thought she was saying,
well, later, Katie edged up to me and said, what did Kylie say to you? Assuming that she'd said, you know, congratulations. And I said, my chiropractor is her cousin.
And at that point, did you think, yes, it's not happening for me tonight?
I did sort of think that. I mean, it was very, very hard to... It was very hard to think anything, really. It was a real whirlwind of an evening. And, you know, once again, like, it's a thing that starts at 6, but they don't announce the winner until 9:52. And there's a lot of alcohol. So I had brought my best friend with me from the States. She also ended up taking my son shopping that fateful day when he needed decent shoes. And her assignment to me was, I got one glass of wine, I think, for 3 hours and 52 minutes. I was like, make sure that I don't drink a second glass of wine.
How do you find it to let go of your characters after a book is finished? You know, have the characters from Flashlight stayed with you?
I think they all stay with me, but... you know, it's not hard to let them go. I mean, I think by the time I finish any book, I'm really quite finished. Mm-hmm. Like, it's, I'm very, very eager to move on to something else. I mean, I'm fond of all my characters. I like talking about them. I think it's nice to talk about them in a context like this, and sort of, you know, it's fun to have readers want to talk about them as if they're actual people, but I don't experience like this urge to write about them further. I've never wanted to write like a sequel. Although, you know, maybe I will one of these days just to see.
Just to surprise us. This has been such a joy. It's a fantastic novel. It's called Flashlight. If you haven't read it, seek it out. Can you please give an enormous round of applause for Susan Choi?
Thank you, Claire.
Susan Choi with me, Claire Nichols, at the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival. Her Booker shortlisted novel is Flashlight. And to hear more conversations with your favourite fiction authors, make sure you're following The Book Show on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.